Observer.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels and Observer politics writer Chris Hooks. Welcome, gents.
Howdy.
Hey, Jonathan.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by freelance writer Maurice Shema, whose story, To Kill or Not to Kill, focuses on the decline of the death penalty and one district attorney's agonizing choice. But first, we have some news to discuss. Chris, in your piece about this, you provided a few potential names for identifying this scandal, and the one I've picked is Vodkagate. So what can you tell us about Vodkagate?
Well, it all started about a year ago when Travis County's district attorney, Rosemary Lemberg, got pulled over a little outside of town with an open vodka bottle in the passenger seat.
Right.
The Travis County Sheriff's deputies didn't take too kindly to that. They arrested her, brought her into jail. A video emerged of Rosemary Lemberg being very uncooperative with sheriff's deputies. Not the kind of thing you like getting out if you're an elected public official.
Some might say entertainingly. You know, uncooperative?
Yes.
Hilariously.
I think that's fair.
Yes. So for a while, it was a local scandal. Some people in Travis County thought she should resign, and some people didn't. She had worked for her office for a long time, had a lot of supporters, and it was a local matter for a while until Governor Rick Perry, who had sparred with Rosemary Lemberg's office, the Travis County DA's office in the past, issued an ultimatum, said that he would defund a critical part of her office, the Public Integrity Unit, which works on state ethics cases, if she didn't resign. And that raised some eyebrows at the time. When he was issuing this threat, it was a kind of unusual thing to do, to demand that a local elected official take an action or face kind of retribution from the governor's office,
sure,
who wields a budget pen. He did veto the budget,
right,
for this office. That was in June of last year, I believe. And since then, there hasn't been a lot of attention on it. There was a complaint filed by a left-leaning watchdog group called Texans for Public Justice, who charged that Perry's action represented bribery, abuse of an official office, and a couple of other pretty weighty charges.
Yeah.
And that kind of went away for a little bit. And what you've seen in the last month is that investigation has kind of started to produce some signs that maybe it's a substantial investigation and that Perry faces the threat of actually being brought up on some of these criminal charges.
Can I ask you one thing that you explained in your explainer story on our site now that helped me understand what's going on here? Is that at the time when Lemberg was arrested, it seemed pretty, it was like, you know, what else would you have to do to need to step down as DA? Like, it looked pretty bad, and then she didn't. And I wasn't really clear on the political wrangling that was going on here. But why was Perry so intent on getting rid of her?
Well, at the time, a lot of people speculated that it had to do with an ongoing investigation into something called the Cancer Prevention Research Institute of Texas, which was a major initiative of Perry's that had been active for a number of years. And the idea was that the legislature would a lot of money to cancer research. And a lot of that money went to people who shouldn't have gotten it. Recently, a senior official from that fund was indicted on a felony charge of helping to distribute money illegally. And a lot of people thought that Perry's action was intended to disrupt that investigation by forcing Rosemary Lemberg to step down.
Mm-hmm.
And if Rosemary Lemberg had stepped down, Rick Perry would appoint her replacement. It was kind of seen as a way for him to get maybe not a crony, but someone who would have been a little bit more receptive to his policy goals into an important watchdog office.
Which is nothing like a crony.
Yes.
Totally different.
Real quick, what is the latest development in this story? I know that something happened earlier this week, right?
Well, we've seen kind of drips and drabs coming out from Travis County government about the aftermath of the veto. It turns out that Governor Perry's office was really active. And even after the veto was signed, he defunded the office. he tried to work out a deal in which Rosemary Lindbergh would step down and he would give back the money. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of edging towards something that looks a lot more like the statute definition of some of these charges that he's been accused of, specifically bribery. It also just came out today that Rick Perry offered Travis County government an assurance that he would appoint a Democrat from her office, and that Rosemary Lindbergh would be able to keep a job within the district attorney's office. And it's sort of strange because it steps maybe the governor closer to the statute violation of bribery, but it kind of complicates the matter because it looks like he would have been willing to appoint someone who would have kept up with some of these investigations. So it's getting messier, but it's maybe not in a way that Rick Perry might hope for.
From there, we go to a story from Patrick. Patrick, what can you tell me about the Texas Achievement School District plan?
Okay, so the Achievement School District does not exist now, but it would be a Texas version of something that a few other states have tried for low-performing schools. Basically, they'd get pulled out of their local school districts and put under the state watch, run by a superintendent of this Achievement School District. I always think of it as like the alternative classroom and the trailer behind the school where the kids go for a while if they're not working out in their classroom.
Only statewide with one superintendent.
Right, and so it would be like extreme intervention for these schools.
Okay.
And this has been Greg Abbott's education proposal that he just released. You know, as governor, this is one of the things that he would do is create this district. It actually was a pretty popular proposal last session at the legislature with bipartisan support. As a lot of school reform stuff like this is, but it got torpedoed. It was a bill authored by a couple Democrats, which is interesting that Abbott is proposing this now as a Republican. Mm-hmm. But a few folks from within the Democratic Party led the charge against this bill and ended up taking it down on a technicality late in the session. It definitely had the votes to pass, though, if it had gone up, and probably next year the legislature is going to do this anyway. But what's happened in other states that have started up school districts like this is that hardcore intervention that the school districts or the schools get in this district often means just handing them over to a charter school.
Is that permanently or until they're fixed?
Well, one of the interesting things in Abbott's proposal, one of the possibilities is you could, in order to be removed from the Achievement School District and handed back to local control, you'd have to, like, part of the agreement would be you'd have to keep the teachers or the charter school or whatever changes were made in place. So that could be like a low-performing school here in Austin gets handed off to this district. If it's ever going to come back to local control, it would have to remain, you know, with whatever charter operator, you know, had you know, been running it. And there are all kinds of out-of-state charter chains that have been brought into Memphis and New Orleans are pretty much the two biggest cities where this kind of thing has happened. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of education groups that are really upset about this idea, like teachers and, you know, public school groups who see this as a play to bring in big charter chains to take over local schools and sort of wrest them away from the public school system.
Surely there are alternatives to this plan, right?
There's a million ones. The thing you run into is, you know, everyone says, well, schools are struggling. You know, what's your idea to do them? And if you don't like this, then do you have some better idea?
Sure.
So you know, from that standpoint, like it's a decent argument. They have some results they've shown in some other cities that they say the graduation rate's higher and when they've tried this in other places. But it's also got a huge backing from some big business groups that have just started to really start a play with Texas education policy. And that's kind of one of those red flags where you see business groups and, you know, big donors to like mainstream Republican candidates who haven't had a huge education interest before. Suddenly, like, they really care about education. And one of the things they really care about all of a sudden is this Achievement School District idea.
Are there versions of this proposal that have been put into place in other states or areas that don't incorporate the charter school aspect of this?
Well, there's Memphis and New Orleans are the two biggest ones, and New Orleans, I think, is about to be almost entirely charter schools now. Michigan has a small one that I think does not include charters, and Virginia is starting one now that looks like it will. But the bill that was out there and Abbott's plan, they both anticipate how charter operators could be brought in. But they don't really, they kind of like skirt the issue of like, they don't say exactly charter schools would come in to run it, but they say if they do, here's who would be making those decisions and here's who would be eligible.
Cool. Guys, thanks for sharing those stories.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Use of the death penalty is on the decline, even in Texas. The state most famous for capital punishment is executing fewer people and handing out fewer death sentences. Maurice Shema examines this trend in To Kill or Not to Kill, his latest story, which tells the inside tale of how a small-town Texas prosecutor handles a death penalty case. Maurice, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, for starters, let's talk about what's contributing to the decline of the death penalty.
I mean, the death penalty is on the decline all over the U.S., and in Texas, it's on the decline as well, and because Texas, you know, traditionally had some of the most death penalty convictions and executions in the U.S., the trend is really sort of stark and dramatic there.
Sure.
And there's lots of reasons, and I think different people with different kind of political stakes in the question tend to answer it differently. But overall, one of the biggest things is that in 2005, the Texas legislature approved life without parole as a sort of possible punishment in death penalty cases, which before then, juries could sentence someone to life in prison, but it actually only meant 40 years. And now a jury can sentence somebody to prison, and it can actually mean sort of forever. And they now, you know, can kind of make the decision between that and the death penalty. But there's a sort of equally or sort of very harsh punishment on the table other than the death penalty that they can pick. Another reason is that there's been more money and sort of increasing skill among death penalty defense attorneys in presenting what's called mitigation evidence, and that's sort of the life story of the person who's being tried for the death penalty. So, you know, where before you used to hear all sorts of stories about death penalty defense lawyers who weren't doing their jobs properly, you hear less of those stories now, and you hear more stories about defendants who, you know, had a really rough childhood or had, you know, different kinds of chemical imbalances in their brain and drug addictions and different kinds of things that led them up towards the murder that they're being tried for. And the reason you hear about those stories more often now is because there's more money for defense attorneys to look for them. And there's a whole kind of class of specialists called mitigation specialists that go after these stories and kind of investigate the background of the defendant and present that story at trial to the jury, which makes it more likely that the jury might be lenient. And then finally, there's the fact that the death penalty is very expensive. And, you know, I don't know that there are statistics that it gets more expensive over time. It's always been very expensive. But now, because convictions every year lead to these sort of convoluted appellate processes, appeals courts, you know, look at more and more death penalty cases, and it takes, you know, years and years and years for these cases to finally get to an execution, and they kind of build up over time. There were a lot of death penalty convictions in the 90s, and those have created a kind of clog over the past few years to where, you know, it costs these DA's departments, you know, millions of dollars sometimes to prosecute just a single case for the death penalty.
Wow.
So it's all of these things kind of swirling together that makes this decline. But the decline is quite stark, you know.
So that's the background of your latest story, but the guy who's the focus of the story is a district attorney named Stephen Reese. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, sure. Stephen Reese is the district attorney of Matagorda County, and he has been for several decades. He's just turned 60 this year, and I found Stephen through a sort of mutual contact who's another prosecutor, and was curious about him because he very recently had this decision to make about whether or not to seek the death penalty in a really gruesome, terrible murder case. And after I sort of talked to him on the phone briefly, I found out that he had actually made the decision about whether to seek the death penalty twice in the relatively recent past, in the late 90s and again in 2007. And in the late 90s, he had decided to go for the death penalty, and in 2007, he had decided not to go for it. And that sort of fit into this broader trend, but I knew that, you know, each case is its own big bundle of particulars, and that, you know, this was a very kind of personal decision for him. So I wanted to just kind of get as far as I could into his mind about how he makes these decisions, because it's ultimately up to him And so he invited me out, and we spent a day kind of talking through these cases. Also, he is the third vice president of the local Lions Club, so he had me to sort of big luncheon, which was really fun. I had never seen anything like that before.
One of the perks of the job.
So,
yeah.
I was wondering if there was anything that really caught you by surprise about this. I mean, obviously, this is a really heavy decision for any human being to make, and that certainly comes across in your story. But was there an aspect of his decision-making process that you did not anticipate?
I don't think that I expected that he would consult with his wife so much about it, and I don't know that this made it into the story. But one thing he told me very pointedly was that he almost always goes to his wife about not just death penalty cases, but all sorts of questions about, you know, what's the appropriate punishment to seek for different kinds of crimes, and that he kind of treats her as one of several important barometers on what community opinion is going to be. It also surprised me that he felt incredibly strongly about wrongful convictions. Another thing that didn't make it into the story was that the one time that he teared up while we were talking was when he brought up the Michael Morton case, and he had met Michael Morton, you know, who, as you probably know, was sentenced to 25 years, or spent 25 years in prison for the murder of his wife, which it later came out he didn't commit. And the prosecutor in that case has gotten into some, you know, legal trouble over that. And Steve was really torn up about the idea that somebody innocent could have gone to prison for so long, and told me, and apparently also told Michael Morton himself, that that was sort of a nightmare, and that was sort of very emotionally troubling. So I think one thing that definitely surprised me was how emotionally involved he was in these kinds of decisions. You know, the traditional stereotype of the district attorney is that they're this very, you know, solid and terse and tough kind of individual. That's certainly the kind of old law and order image that we all conjure. And he struck me as a much more kind of romantic spirit, a much more kind of emotionally engaged person than that. So I'd say that was one of the biggest surprises.
Yeah, that stereotype that you mentioned, you know, of the DA would suggest to me that, like, maybe the DAs typically wouldn't want to talk about those decisions that are so personal and probably the biggest thing that they do in their jobs. Why do you think he was so open with you?
I think he talked to me partially because this mutual contact we had was a man named Shannon Edmonds, who's the Texas District and County Attorneys Association spokesperson at the Texas Legislature. And we had worked together a lot during the legislature, you know, when I just needed some, you know, thoughts or comments from a prosecutor about a particular bill. And so I developed a rapport with him that I think allowed him to tell Steve Reese that I was trustworthy and that I wasn't going to rake him over the coals. I mean, I think that in addition to these prosecutors being kind of tough and quiet about cases, all of these sort of Michael Morton-style stories have not helped in terms of their willingness to talk to the media.
Sure.
But in Steve's case, I think he had just spent a lot of years really not telling anybody, you know, a journalist or, I mean, he told his family about these decisions probably really deeply, but I think it had built up over time, and he kind of finally felt like he was at a place in his career where he could put a story like this out and not suffer political fallout for it. And that maybe it would kind of help people understand where he's coming from. You know, I think he really wanted people to see that there's this human decision behind what he ends up coming out with, and that it's a struggle for him, you know?
Well, Maurice, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. For his films Please Don't Bury Me Alive, Chicano Love Is Forever, and Run, Tecato, Run, Efrain Gutierrez is considered a pioneer of Chicano cinema. Now, with some help from the UCLA Film and Television Archive, Gutierrez's films have been restored. Gutierrez is in Austin this week, where some of his films will be shown at the Cine Las Americas Film Festival. For an interview with Gutierrez, we go to Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque.
Hi, Efrain.
Hi,
it's
Melissa.
So good to have you here at the Cine Las Americas Film Festival in Austin. And I wrote a piece about you in April and about your groundbreaking filmmaking that you did in the 70s, the first Chicano full-length feature film. And it's really great to see you, and you're showing your films through Sunday. So if anybody's in Austin, you should come out to Cine Las Americas and see Efrain's films showing. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, and it's good to have you here, about how your films are being received. I know, I think you had the first showing on Wednesday?
Yesterday, yes.
Uh-huh. And how did that go? How were
your films
received?
Great. I mean, I always, I enjoy talking to people, and like I tell them, I don't mind, you know, whatever bothers them or whatever that they didn't like or they didn't, I enjoy talking to people. So we had, I think I stayed like about almost an hour talking to the people here, so, and they were all so nice, and I'm very impressed that there's so many educators. Like I had, like I've met four or five professors that have come by and talked to me, and from one from UT San Antonio even came down. So, you know, I am so overwhelmed with the reception we're getting. So very, very positive, very happy with it.
And the film that showed on Wednesday was Please Don't Bury Me Alive, correct?
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about that film and what year you made it and when it came out? Okay, what it's about?
Please Don't Bury Me Alive. We started filming around 74 and we released it in 76. That's the, it's got a lot of story, but we did that, I guess, because we had never seen Mexican Americans or Chicanos on the screen before. And that had always bothered me, you know, growing up, and we were doing theater. And we realized that nobody was really producing films, either in Mexico or in the United States, relating to our culture, meaning the Chicano culture, and our Chicano problems that we were running into. And back then, we had problems with, you know, the justice system that we felt was not equal. Education definitely was not equal. So this was some of the things that were really hurting, you know, still do in the minorities like Chicanos. And with all these problems that are going on, you know, I asked people, why couldn't we make our own movie? I'm talking to people like Ricardo Montalban from that era, who was real popular back then in 70 when I was in Nosotros, school that he had in Los Angeles. And then after I talked to Anthony Quinn, Luis Valdez, and everybody was saying, no, it can't be done. Screen Actors Guild, you know, the Writers Guild, don't even think about it. So around that time, I was with another theater group that was run by Emilio Delgado. Emilio is the Milo who comes out in Sesame Street, the first Mexican-American. He went on board in 70. He had a TV show in Los Angeles. But before he left to New York to be with Sesame Street, he had taken us to go see Luis Valdez and Teatro Campesino do organize the farm workers to get into the union in San Fernando Valley. That's when it really floored me, and I said, wow, this is awesome, you know. So I started a theater group, and then that was in 71. I came back to San Antonio, and then after that, I started thinking about the possibility of putting it on film, what we were doing in stage, because it's a big hassle taking 20, 15, 10 students, and then most of the young high school students, and having problems. So we said, you know what we're gonna do, and my partner and I said, let's do a film and take it to the school. So and I'm glad that all these professors are seeing it, because our first intent was not to show it at the theaters, because we didn't think, you know, we wouldn't even imagine that, you know, the people would accept the theaters. But we said we can show it at the universities, because there was a demand with the teatro, because we toured Midwest, we toured California, we toured Mexico, and it was all through universities mostly that we were presenting our theater. So that was a goal, to do that. But when we started filming, we finished, people started saying, hey, you guys are the first making a first independent Chicano movie. And so they said, you know what? Well, let's try it in the theaters. And that's when we tried to go to the Mexican theaters, and they turned us down. We went to the American theaters, the English theaters, and Santico and San Antonio, you know, basically they all laughed at us. And Jack Landman, my friend at Trinity University that helped us a lot, said, you know, why don't you four-wall the theaters? So we four-walled the theaters, and I mean, this thing just caught fire. I mean, we were kind of caught off completely off guard. We didn't know what was going on. Because we had, you know, in Diario that Mexico City writes up a story about us. We were invited to TV, and people wanted to know and hear us. And I think that the reason that it was so successful, because that's a question that everybody asks, why do you think it was so successful? You know, because it's not the greatest film once you see it, you know. It's got a lot of technical problems, because we didn't have the equipment. We weren't trained actors. We weren't trained cinematographers. So everything we were doing kind of on-the-job training. And I think that when we showed it on the screen, I think Chicanos and Mexican Americans, wherever we went, were just awed by the fact that they were seeing something that they could relate to, and what we say, our own brown face is up on the silver screen, which had never been seen. So with that, Mexico eventually came after us, and it's another story, but Agra Sanchez is a guy that bought it from Mexico, and all they did was take it in 76. We had it for like 3 months. We made about $300,000 back then in the 3 months that we had it. They promised us, a lot of money and to take it to Spain, Cuba, and Mexico and all that. But all they did was just take it and shelved it, and the movie was actually never shown again until UCLA found me, and then they wanted to restore it. And long story short, they end up getting my rights back, and they archived it at UCLA, and they're the ones that have the prints and everything that what they've done for me.
So you bring up how groundbreaking it was to have a film about Mexican Americans in true life, what they were facing, complex Correct. Issues like poverty, racism, drug addiction, and all these things that weren't being shown on the screen at that time. Do you think that we've come a long way since then, or do you think Mexican Americans still aren't accurately portrayed in media?
I think that, we've made some inroads. I still am very disappointed. I don't see, because I can still, when I was young, we used to say this. I'm talking, when we started, you could count the Latino actors back then, Ricardo Montalban, Anthony Quinn, I forgot this lady from Puerto Rico. But once you get to number 4 or 5, you have a hard time remembering who they were. But it was basically the same people that were there. Pedro Gonzalez as a flunky for John Wayne. But I'm gonna say, so now basically you have the same thing. You got James Olmos, basically running in every show that you come out in, Chish Marin. Once you start getting after the five main Latino actors that we could say we can relate to, they're more Chicano, more Mexican-American, that's about it. We don't really have, Chavira, who I knew, his father, Chavira had the Chicano Arts Theater here in Austin. We feel a kinship to some of that. We're proud, even though the Antonio Chavira, the young one, I never knew him, but I knew his father, and his father, is part of the teatro, and I took the Chicano Arts Theater name, from his name that he had here in Austin when he was here. So, but we don't, that's what I see. I would like to see, the blacks, I admire them for the fact that, they don't have just one, they don't have two, they have their own TV channel. And that's what I foresaw that we would have, maybe Robert Rodriguez is gonna do it. But, I always thought that we should have, our own TV channel where we could, do our own stories. I thought that we could, we should have a lot of movies by now. Sadly, most of the movies that started coming out and what the Chicano cinema has been known for more is for drug and gang movies kind of thing.
If you'd like to hear the rest of Melissa's interview with Efrain Gutierrez, you can at texasobserver.org. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.